Bipartisan congressional negotiators have unveiled a long-awaited budget framework to stabilize the government's finances into the near future. But does it have enough support to pass? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Representative Paul Ryan and Senator Patty Murray announced the deal yesterday. We'll ask our analysts, Bruce Nesmith of Coe College and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, what they think of it. Before all that, though, I'll talk with NPR political correspondent Don Gagne, who will be visiting Iowa next week. We'll get his view on the latest in politics and ask him to give us a peek behind the scenes at his work in Washington. Politics Day starts with Don Gagne after this news. Later in the program, on River to River, two of our regular political analysts, Tim Hagel and Bruce Nesmith, will join us. But first, we have the distinct pleasure of being joined by NPR political correspondent Don Gagne, joining us by phone. Don, are you there?
I am here. I want to tell you, it's freezing here in Washington. It's something like 38 degrees.
Oh, we feel. Oh, you're going right for the jugular, right at the beginning. I biked into work today, Don, and it was something like 10 degrees. So I'm going to have a bike out ready for you when you come to Des Moines. And I think you're only allowed to wear like a bathing suit, maybe.
That's a deal. I wore more than that on RAGBRAI this summer.
We'll no doubt chat about that on Tuesday as well. But we want to remind our listeners that you are coming to Iowa for Politics and a Pint next Tuesday, December 17th. There'll be a VIP reception at 5 o'clock, and then 7 o'clock we'll have another discussion. Lots of fun in store at the venue at Court Center in Des Moines. We're also going to make it a broadcast, Don, for a later broadcast right here on River to River. I wonder if we can just preview some of the things that we're going to talk about. I'd like to get your reaction to a few things that have been happening politically in the next few minutes. For instance, we've got the late announcement yesterday evening, the bipartisan budget deal announced. What questions does this raise for you?
Well, it's most meaningful because of that word you used to describe it, bipartisan. That is something we have not seen much of at all during this Congress, and really during the Obama years, for that matter. So it is significant. We have you know, Democratic Senator Patty Murray, and we have Republican Congressman Paul Ryan, both leaders in their party, and of course Ryan's name gets bandied about a great deal as a potential presidential candidate after he was on the ticket with Mitt Romney in 2012. That was just last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, and he has been visiting Iowa, so he is making those moves.
So it's not a huge deal in terms of what they have actually struck. But it is a deal, and it does kind of move us beyond the sequester that has been in place since this time last year. And it also lets a little of the steam off. Yeah. that has been building up in the pressure cooker that has been, budget talks, with the constant fear of government shutdowns, which we had, and the fear of the debt ceiling not being raised. It just kind of eases off on all of that just a bit. It doesn't mean it will be all sweetness and light going forward. Believe me, it won't be all sweetness and light going forward. They'll still be fighting about health care and its implementation, and they'll still be fighting about all kinds of things. But for now, as we head into the holidays, we saw a Democrat and a Republican on the Hill jointly announcing something, and mm-hmm. that was a sight to behold.
A few moments ago, I noticed on Twitter that Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley predicts the Ryan-Murray budget plan will pass in the House by Friday, with some GOP opposition to it, but they'll also then pass in the Senate next week, is Senator Grassley's prediction. So I guess enough votes. What in the middle there? We're predicting that the arch conservatives and the arch liberals will not be on board here.
Yeah, I think that's the best bet. And the middle, of course, is not as big as it used to be in Washington. Each party is, the Democrats are more Democratic and more liberal. The Republicans certainly have the Tea Party wing pulling them to the right, so there is less of a middle, but it does look like, you know, there will be kind of a wide swath in the middle that will largely support this. I saw somebody today say, you know, look for there to be more votes from Democrats than Republicans on this. But again, you know, it's early. But if you have Senator Grassley saying what you just had him saying, then that certainly does look like it's he knows how to count votes, Senator mm-hmm. Grassley does. So yeah,
we have a few new presidential polls out here, opinion polls. More Americans disapproving of the president's job performance than ever before, mm-hmm. and according to this NBC News Wall Street Journal poll. Ending 2013 in 2013 in some tough shape. The last 2 months has really been brutal for the administration with this botched health care rollout, and now more Americans disapproving of his job performance than ever before. 54%, half of the country saying they're either disappointed or dissatisfied with his presidency. 54% believe he's facing a long-term setback. So, how much of that decreased popularity, Don Gagne, do you think can be attributed to that disastrous rollout of ACA?
Well, first the bigger picture is welcome to a second term presidency. I mean, this does happen in second terms, but certainly the ongoing fights over the ACA and the rollout didn't help. And it's interesting. I was looking at a New York Times poll, a New York Times CBS poll, and people don't blame him for the troubled rollout as much as you might think they would, because it was, you know, a huge problem as they launched this thing, and it only now, you know, appears to have stabilized, and as the administration say, you know, works for most people who get on, and the reports we're getting are that it does keep getting better, and it is largely, you know, I use that word a little advisedly, but it's largely working at this point. But it affects the administration in other ways. It just kind of it prevents them from talking about other things. When they do talk about other things, they're accused of trying to distract from that problem. There are people who are still asking why some heads didn't roll as it relates to the troubled rollout. Mm-hmm. So it creates an environment where you don't see them on track and on their game and talking about what they want to, and that's just going to hurt you. It just is.
And doesn't it put a question mark in people's minds too, because when you shoot yourself in the foot, as the administration did here, and they have enough people attacking them that they don't need to have a self-inflicted wound, that when you shoot yourself in the foot, aren't you putting your administration in question?
It gives the people who maybe were inclined to give you the benefit of the doubt on a lot of things just kind of a moment's pause. So that's a question of, you know, the degree to which people have confidence in your administration and how you're doing the job. And it's, you know, it's not like the months leading up to that were a picnic for him either. You know, the budget battles and the government shutdown, while that all certainly hurt Republicans and that stuff, the Republicans took, you know, the bigger hits in terms of public opinion on that. That kind of a fight's not good for the White House either. It's, you know, you get a lot of people saying a pox on both of your houses.
Mm-hmm. We'll see where this new budget deal goes. But one of the president's key issues that has been shoved to the back burner due to the fiscal showdown, sequester, the bad rollout of Obamacare has been comprehensive immigration reform, which would really be a big deal. Do you see that happening in 2014?
I don't know. I just don't know. You know, there is certainly plenty of incentive for Democrats and Republicans to pass it, but there are also huge obstacles, especially, you know, the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. The word amnesty is thrown out, and they oppose anything that includes a path to citizenship. And just the question is, can they get the votes to pass anything meaningful. I think we're going to see a lot of work on it, and I think we will see probably a lot of give and take. And the question then will be is whatever bill they come up with in the end, how comprehensive will it be? There is certainly a possibility it could pass. Something could pass, though not as comprehensive as immigration reform advocates would like. But I'm not ready to predict one way or another that something will pass next year.
The Tea Party, you've mentioned several times in our conversation, looking for what will happen with the Tea Party in 2014. We're seeing, I think that the figure I saw, Don, was 8 of 12 Senate races with GOP sitting senators are being challenged by Tea Party candidates.
And that doesn't count House races where incumbent Republicans are being challenged as well. I did a piece a couple of weeks back in central Pennsylvania where a longtime establishment Republican Congressman Bill Schuster is being challenged by a Tea Partier who's got money. So you've got it in the Senate, certainly. You've got it in the House. What it means is the Tea Party is going to be a part of the discussion in a very big way. And some of these challengers will be well-funded. Some not so much. Some will have a very good shot at winning. Some will be long shots all along and won't ever rise above that level. But they're going to be part of the dialogue, and some of them could win, at least in the primaries. And depending on where that is, Democratic challengers will be kind of licking their chops because mm-hmm. they'd much rather run against a Tea Party nominee who knocked off an incumbent than a sitting incumbent. But it also means that we will have these key places around the country, in Texas, in Mississippi, in Pennsylvania, where you will, in effect, in Republican primaries, have a bit of a referendum on where the Tea Party is. And it's going to be one of the big stories to watch next year.
NPR's Don Gagne with us for a few minutes. You can catch him in Des Moines next Tuesday, Politics and a Pint, Tuesday, December 17th. And find out more about that ticket information at iowapublicradio.org. 2 years from now, Don, this exact moment, we'll be in the final days leading up to the 2016 Iowa caucuses. Shame on us for talking about it so early. But I'm going to ask you about your thoughts about Iowa's role in 2016. Of course, polls showing Hillary Clinton a huge favorite among Democrats, but history tells us we would be mistaken to call her a shoo-in, wouldn't she?
We certainly would, because recall, she was kind of the shoo-in this time in 2007, I guess.
2007,
right? Yeah. Things happen, and people come out of the blue, and, outside events affect the national mood and the kind of candidate they might want. But we do know Iowa's still first. We do know Iowa will probably happen in January of 2016. And we know that it is going to be wide open on both sides in terms of, no incumbent, no real heir apparent, certainly not for the Republicans. And while Hillary Clinton will be the favorite, I just can't believe that somebody won't decide that they're going to try to make a fight of it in mm-hmm. Iowa and New Hampshire and on from there. But unlike the last one, there's going to be plenty of action on both sides, and we don't even know what the world will look like, not just in terms of politics, but in terms of what the media landscape is going to look like. And we don't know how we'll be covering it yet. We don't know what kind of new tricks campaigns will have up their sleeves in terms of how they use social media and technology and all of that. Iowa's obviously a place where you need to visit all 99 counties, and it remains a very grassroots, up close and personal place. But we are going to see that tradition adapting to a new world, and we don't know what that world's going to look like just yet, given how fast things have changed just in the past few years.
We have a minute or so left, Don, but you mentioned you've been in Iowa, of course, many times reporting. You were on RAGBRAI this past year. Just a few seconds to tell us about your favorite moment in RAGBRAI, and on Tuesday we'll get into a little bit more of it, I hope.
But you know, my favorite moment, I'm a little, I feel a little guilty saying this, but it was, catching glimpse of the Mississippi River.
And, doing the tire dip.
Well, but it was also kind of bittersweet because, you know, the first couple of days you're just plain exhausted. I'd never done this before. And by the end, you, this is such a cliche, forgive me, but you kind of, you think of all the new friends you've made along the way and all of the great conversations. And while you're thrilled that you've made it, you've got this sense of accomplishment, you're already thinking about next year in that moment.
Oh, we hope you'll be there next year. Don Gagne, thank you very much for joining us, and see you on Tuesday.
All right, see you next week. Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, Politics Wednesday. And joining us now for the remainder of the hour, Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Welcome back, Tim.
Hey there.
And Bruce Nesmith, joining us by phone, the Joan and Abbott Lipsky Professor of Political Science at Coe College. Hi, Bruce.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon. Let's talk, rifle through a number of developments in our time. We had Don Gagne on our first half hour, so we have sort of an abbreviated or condensed version of getting through the many political developments that have happened since our last Politics Wednesday. Let's talk about this budget deal announced late last night. Yesterday, key budget negotiators, Congressman Paul Ryan, chair of the House Budget Committee, Senator Patty Murray, chair of the Senate Budget Committee, announced they had reached a budget agreement. In a joint news conference last night, they outlined the bipartisan deal and the work that made it possible.
From the outset, we knew that if we forced each other to compromise a core principle, we would get nowhere. That is why we decided to focus on where the common ground is. So that's what we've done. That means to me a budget agreement that reduces the deficit without raising taxes and replaces some of the arbitrary across-the-board spending cuts with smarter, permanent reforms that pay for this relief. I think this agreement is a clear improvement on the status quo. This agreement makes sure that we don't have a government shutdown scenario in January. It makes sure that we don't have another government shutdown scenario in October. It makes sure that we don't lurch from crisis to crisis. It also allows Congress to finally exercise the power of the purse. We're both from the legislative branch. The Constitution says that the legislative branch should exercise the power of the purse. We want to reclaim that from the administration instead of having all of these continuing resolutions. This also shows that we can work together to get our government functioning at its very basic levels. That, we think, is a step in the right direction. That, we think, gives us some confidence. That brings some normalcy back to our government.
Well, for far too long here in Washington, D.C., compromise has been considered a dirty word, especially when it comes to the federal budget. Over the past few years, we have lurched from crisis to crisis and from one cliff to the next. And when one countdown clock was stopped, it wasn't too long before the next one got started. That uncertainty was devastating to our fragile economic recovery. The constant crisis cost us billions of dollars in lost growth and jobs, and the continued across-the-board cuts from sequestration were forcing our families and communities to pay the price. So I am very proud to stand here today with Chairman Ryan to announce we have broken through the partisanship and the gridlock and reached a bipartisan budget compromise that will prevent a government shutdown in January.
Senator Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington, before that, Representative Paul Ryan, Republican from Wisconsin, announcing last night a fiscal framework that would help eliminate the constant threat of government shutdown, under which lawmakers have worked for the better part of the last 3 years. Tim Hagel, Bruce Nesmith with us. Let me go to each of you. Tim, let's start with you. How do you gauge the significance of this announcement? It has not yet passed the House nor the Senate. Senator Grassley tweeted today that he predicts it will pass the House this week and the Senate early next week. How do you judge the significance of this?
Well, as some commentators said fairly quickly, it's significant in the sense, not so much into how much, as Paul Ryan was saying, the deficit is reduced, and especially given it's over a 10-year period, that 23 or 28, you'd see some different figures on this, billion dollars is not a whole lot. But on the other hand, it's a step in the right direction. And as Senator Murray was saying, that it's a compromise, and Representative Ryan indicated that they looked to the core principles and tried to find some common ground. And in that sense, it's a step in trying to, again, work together to a certain extent. And maybe it's not a lot, but it's a little bit, perhaps. And as one other person indicated, this is like getting a pair of sturdy socks rather than a new bike. This is Jonah Goldberg on NRO.
I like that.
The alternative, of course, is for the folks that were holding out for the new bike, is that they might have gotten a lump of coal instead. So better take the socks than nothing.
Bruce Nesmith, I think we heard Patty Murray there saying compromise no longer a dirty word. Do you believe we're in a new era there?
I don't know if I'd go that far, but I think, you know, that this is one of those situations that you have to crawl before you walk. And I think that to have expected an earth-shaking agreement, or, you know, suddenly the political landscape and patterns changing entirely, is probably a little bit too much. This is a small step, but I think, you know, it's a significant step because it's not nothing, and it's not a constant a demonizing of the other side.
Today, we heard this morning House Speaker John Boehner lashing out at some conservative advocacy groups that have encouraged GOP lawmakers to oppose this budget framework. Tim Hagel, do you think it'll have enough support? We have Senator Grassley saying it will. Paul Ryan on board. We have to believe there are enough Republican votes, aren't there?
There probably are. Again, you'd have to see what the eventual count is, whip count and so forth. But there are going to be some people that, for a variety of reasons, are going to oppose this. Those that oppose it simply on principle, saying that, look, yeah, baby steps are fine, but we're facing a huge problem here. And this is sort of another way to put this. This must be analogy day, I guess, where it's, I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. And this is a story that Tea Party folks have been hearing over and over and over again, that they want to see the cuts now if we're going to have, you know, revenue enhancement with not new taxes but some kinds of user fees and so forth. And then there's some people that are going to be concerned that if they don't go for this, that the political repercussions would be very bad for the Republicans, and so that enters the fray as well.
Mm-hmm. Also significant, not only what's in this agreement, but what I believe is outside this agreement. It doesn't raise the debt ceiling, doesn't extend federal unemployment benefits, which expire December 28th. Do you see significance there, Bruce Nesmith? A reason for another catfight or a couple?
Well, you know, the one thing is that if we avoid the battle over the shutdown in January, but then have a battle over the debt ceiling, have we really done anything that's going to look any different to most people in America? And so that would be some indication to me that, I don't know, that if they can find this the spending cuts that they've promised, that probably the debt ceiling will be negotiable. The unemployment benefits is a tricky political and policy issue, because on the one hand, there's at least an expectation. There's only so long you can string people along on unemployment benefits. On the other hand, the economy hasn't improved so well that there's a lot for these people to do, and so you are kind of throwing people into the snow as kind of the major cost bearers of this agreement.
Bruce Nesmith with us of Coe College, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa Politics. Wednesday, we want to move on to another significant world event this week to get your insights on this. President Obama, among the leaders from around the world, to paying tribute to Nelson Mandela at a memorial service yesterday in Johannesburg, South Africa. In a speech at that event, Obama said that both the United States and South Africa had to overcome centuries of racial subjugation, that he himself is the beneficiary of that sacrifice and struggle, but he said there is much more to do.
We cannot allow our progress to cloud the fact that our work is not yet done. The struggles that follow the victory of formal equality or universal franchise may not be as filled with drama and moral clarity as those that came before, but they are no less important. For around the world today, we still see children suffering from hunger and disease. We still see rundown schools, We still see young people without prospects for the future. Around the world today, men and women are still imprisoned for their political beliefs and are still persecuted for what they look like and how they worship and who they love. That is happening today. And so we too must act on behalf of justice. We too must act on behalf of peace. There are too many people who happily embrace Madiba's legacy of racial reconciliation, but passionately resist even modest reforms that would challenge chronic poverty and growing inequality.
President Obama yesterday in South Africa, the word Madiba there, the clan, name of the clan, which Nelson Mandela is a member, a title of affection for him. Bruce Nasmith, what do you take away from this tribute to Nelson Mandela from around the world and the fact that President Obama in some ways has parallels here, was inspired by Nelson Mandela?
Well, you know, first of all, I think it's really hard to get a balanced viewpoint on somebody right after they die. I think we've had a number of major figures around the world who have died over the last 10, 15, 20 years who in their lifetime could be polarizing figures, but you know, you don't hear a lot about that, you know, right after they die. Maybe give it a few months or something like that. They get a little honeymoon period. Not that they're around to enjoy it. But I think what Mandela has been able to do is something really remarkable in that he's been able to move past what might have been a polarizing stage of his career and really to think beyond the conflict. And I think when I look at stuff like, say, Israel and Palestine or things from the former Yugoslavia in the 1990s, I think that you see a lot of the principles in both sides looking for reparations from the past, that there's been injustice to their side in the past or things that they've suffered in the past, and they want that paid for before you move on to the next thing. And I think what Mandela was able to do really, you know, from the moment he was released from prison, and maybe before that too, but when he started making public statements, is to look beyond the past of apartheid and look forward to what is the post-apartheid South Africa going to look like? And in that sense, I think he's been a real inspiration for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that his inspiration can apply to politics or much more broadly to each and every one of our lives and the conflicts that we have in terms of truth and reconciliation, overcoming past pains. Tim Hagel, your reflections on the legacy of Nelson Mandela.
Well, no, I think Bruce basically nailed it in the sense that right now we're in this period, for him at least, where people are emphasizing the positive, looking for particularly the importance of the reconciliation and so forth. Even he himself said you have to be careful not to consider him a saint unless, as he said, that you define a saint as a sinner who is still trying. And that's probably true. I think that there's a certain resistance from some people to not deify Mandela and to think that, look, he is a human being, he had his faults, and even post-release from prison that he was saying some things that might not have sat well in terms of who he was associating with and who he praised and so forth. But I think at this time that it's understandable that people do want to emphasize the positive and so forth, and then later we'll see more balanced histories as we move on. But hopefully try to keep it from not being too political, at least at this time.
Ed is joining us from Robbins. Ed, one of our listeners. So welcome to Politics Wednesday, Ed. What's on your mind, the Mandela commemoration?
Yes, I'm just wondering if Mr. Obama can learn something from the art of reconciliation by Mandela and make something out of his handshake to Mr. Castro, a sort of his version of Nixon goes to China.
Mm-hmm. This was much made of this handshake, many handshakes, of course, a president has at such an event, but one of them with the current president of Cuba, Raul Castro, the brother of Fidel. Your thoughts on that, Bruce Nasmith?
Well, Obama isn't Nixon. You know, the Nixon analogy would be clearer if Romney or McCain were president. You know, I think that any Democrat has the suspicion of being associated with socialism, and particularly with Obama's background in neighborhood organizing and things like that. So I don't know, other than, you know, the softening of the rigidity with our relationship with Iran, if you know, this is some seed that can be planted that might down the road lead to a loosening of American and Cuban whatever you call it, non-relations.
And even if President Obama would like to make overtures to Cuba, improve those relationships, it complicates our electoral map, doesn't it? Because Florida is such a pivotal state, such a swing state, Tim Hagel.
Absolutely. And very shortly after this, when people started to be concerned about the handshake, and people were saying, and this seemed reasonable, is that, well, look, he was coming up the stairs, he's got a line of people, it would be rude for him, particularly under the circumstances, to not shake Castro's hand, although there was a bit of a conversation there, and I'd like to know what they said to each other. But you can understand, too, the concerns of many Cuban Americans who lived under repression now, of course, many years, but may have family there, and you've got the political prisoners. But even Obama, in his speech, in the clip that you played, indicated that, you know, there are still places in the world that are holding people because of, among other things, their political beliefs, and Cuba is certainly one of them. So, you know, maybe, if you'll pardon the expression, he gave with one hand and took away with the other.
Tim Hagel, Bruce Nesmith with us for Politics Wednesday, 1-866-780-9100 if you'd like to join our conversation. A new NBC News Wall Street Journal poll finding more Americans disapprove of the president's job performance than ever before. Half say they're either disappointed or dissatisfied with his presidency. 54% believe he's facing a long-term setback. Bruce Nesmith, can he rebound in 2014? If so, how?
Well, it's difficult. I think when Don Gagne was on, he talked about, you know, this is the reality of second-term presidents. Where second-term presidents have bounced back, it has tended to be less to their own efforts than to good fortune. And I think of the improved economy in the late Clinton administration, and then also some overreaching and missteps by Ken Starr when he was investigating him. So you know, I think absent some you know, really extreme statements by Republicans or something like that that start terrifying people, or an anticipated upsurge in the economy, I think this is pretty much what Obama's got for a while.
Mm-hmm. A long-term setback in history would have been the model of his predecessor, George W. Bush, whose approval numbers dwindled until he left office. But if we talk about short-term ones, you referred to Bill Clinton, but we can also see what Tim Hagel, Ronald Reagan in office had a dip in his popularity at the beginning of his second term.
He did, and you know, part of that, of course, he did to get reelected, and fairly convincingly so, but it was an economy situation. But by the end of his second term, the economy was improving, and it was enough that when George H.W. Bush was elected, many thought of it as effectively a third term for Reagan administration. And of course, by the time of Bush 41's first term, the economy had soured again, which caused Clinton to get, among other things, caused Clinton to get elected. So as far as Obama's concerned, though, the problem that he's going to have, of course, is what's going to happen in the midterm elections, because if he doesn't have a Congress that's more willing to work with him than the one that's currently in place, which is to say, if you have Republicans are probably going to hold the House, but if the Democrats don't hold the Senate, then it's going to be even a bigger problem for Obama. And that may not hurt his popularity that much, but it's not going to help him get his agenda in. And as I think by the time we get to the end of Obama's term, that, you know, unless things are really sour, that his popularity might go up, but that's not going to help him a whole lot, I think, mm-hmm. in terms of, again, getting his agenda through.
You mentioned the Democrats holding the Senate. Well, interesting in this, so as we look to 2014, Tea Partiers lining up to tackle GOP senators in primaries getting primaried. We're hearing more and more about that in 8 of the 12 races involving sitting GOP senators. Senators Mitch McConnell, for instance, Thad Cochran of Pat Roberts of Kansas, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. This week, the newest target, Texas Senator John Cornyn. So when we look at that, Bruce Nesmith, how does that complicate this for the GOP? Because wasn't it in our last election that some analysts criticized the Tea Party for losing some seats that would have otherwise been perhaps captured by more mainstream, moderate GOP candidates?
And in 2010 as well. So it's been two now. I think this is really interesting. I think, we're obviously not in 2010. The time has passed and things have changed. It is certainly possible. We've seen plenty of examples in the last couple of election cycles where Republican insurgents who were seen as too conservative or who were made easy targets in the general election didn't win, and that may have cost Republicans some easily winnable Senate seats. I don't know to what extent this continues. This pattern continues. Mm-hmm. The primary. You can always have a primary, but are Tea Party insurgents going to be as successful in primaries this time as they were last time, or have mainstream Republicans? I think break off that sentence and go with another one. I think that a number of business groups have become more active in advocating for mainstream Republicans against Tea Party challengers, and that they may tip a balance differently this time than they have the last couple of election cycles.
Tim Hagel, your view.
Yeah, along those lines, I would say that we probably aren't going to see the anomalies. I would say things like the Angle or Christine McDonnell or some of those folks that you can point to that are the ones that were those supposed seats that we had lost. What's probably going to happen, though, is the Tea Party still wants to exert its influence. And, of course, it has influence in Congress because we can point to the seats it lost, but there were a number of folks where the Tea Party folks won. In terms of many of these challenges now, though, I'm not sure that they're going to be as successful, that they might be more along the lines of trying to keep that incumbent aware that there are, in fact, voters that are still concerned about the fiscal issues that caused the Tea Party to come into existence in the first place, and so that they have to watch for their base and make sure that their base is happy enough.
And perhaps, though, in that primary fight, then being forced to make some statements that would be less moderate than they would like and could be used against them in a general election.
That might be. But again, when you're talking incumbents, it's always difficult to defeat an incumbent unless you've got a race that they're pretty close on anyway.
Okay. Thank you very much. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Bruce Nesmith, the Joan and Abbott Lipsky Professor of Political Science at Coe College. Gentlemen, thank you very much for working over the latest in politics. We appreciate your expertise.
Welcome.
Thanks, Ben.
And do remember that Don Gagne, next Tuesday in Des Moines, as part of our Politics and a Pint, NPR's Don Gagne, live as part of our Insights series. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.